hit record, because we do record all of these and we turn them into podcasts. So if you absolutely love this, you can send the link to your friends. But thanks for coming today. I'm Sadie. I'll be moderating. I think I know most people in the room at this point. We've got just kind of a standard list of questions that we kind of use to guide the conversation. But obviously, if any questions come up from the audience or amongst ourselves, you know, just feel free to shout it out. We're a pretty informal group here. So I think we'll first start with introductions by our illustrious panel here. Mary, I'm going to have you start first.
I'm Mary Kading, and I have been a techie and a backstage person and other things here since 1988, something like that. I haven't actually propped a show for about 5 years, so full disclosure, but I've done probably 50 or 60 shows here, so I know the prop room pretty well. I continue to spend time in the prop room a lot, so that's me.
I'm Sadie. I've been here at TRP for 9 or 10 years now already. I can't believe that somehow. I've done a variety of different things, set props, a few ASM things. I'm on the technical advisory board, and I'm on the board of directors here at Theater in the Round, and I like moderating these panels. Super fun. So,
my name is Bobby, Bobby Smith. I have been here since 2000. I started out as a stage manager for about 5 shows, and then switched to props because my day job wouldn't allow me to stage manage. And I've done about 40 shows here, 30, 40 shows here, and work at several other theaters around the Twin Cities, most recently Park Square.
My name is George Rester. I'm directing Rhinoceros this season. This is going to be my 3rd show here, which I'm thrilled about, because I've always wanted to direct here. I teach theater and film studies at Inver Hills Community College, and I have a summer outdoor Shakespeare theater called Shakespeare and Company that we do 3 shows in rep outdoors. I started out my career, I was acting, and then I got a chance to direct early in college. But I've always worked backstage in some fashion, whether it's building sets or lighting or props, and was a stagehand, professional stagehand for a number of years. So I sort of crossed the divide between the onstage and the backstage, because I've always liked all aspects of theater.
So. I'm Dan Peterson. I've directed several shows here, I think 21 with this state show that's currently on stage, 22 with Jeeves in Bloom that is opening the end of this season. I've also acted in several shows here as well as around town. I taught English and drama for 34 years out in Roseville and did 60-some, probably closer to 70-some shows as a high school director. And in high school, you have to do everything. So, and I also just feel that there's a real connection with designers and the director, designers and actors. As an actor, I always have deepest respect for the designers on the show and want them to know that. And as a director, certainly the same thing. When we work cooperatively, want them to know how important they are to the whole process.
Great. Excellent. So I always like to kick it off with a nice broad question. In your own words, how do you think that props impact the storytelling of the play? And George, I'm going to volunteer you to go first.
Sure. Well, they add depth and texture to the storyline. You can just look around in Dan's set here, and you've got the wonderful illustrated magazine there, and the different books and all the different photos and that. They just add that kind of depth and texture. And each show's a bit different in that way. If you're doing a historical play, because this one's set, what's the time frame?
1670.
Or if you're doing a contemporary, or if you're doing a 14th century play, it all varies a great deal as to what. But it certainly can add that just that little moment that the audience is watching and they see a prop from a particular time period, just connect them into that aspect of the story. So,
great.
Yeah.
Bobby, would you like to go next?
For me, as a props designer, one thing I like to mention to a cast when they're doing the read-through and they're introduced to their designers, so I usually like to mention to the actors, if you are creating a backstory for your character and some type of history, if you want something specific on the set or something to carry on that helps with your backstory, let me know as soon as possible, and I will help create that for you to help set your character. As far as putting stuff on a set, I personally tend to look more at silhouettes and the shape of things more than color. I let the set designer kind of guide me as far as colors on the set, between the director and the set designer, let them pick the, because it's more important color-wise for them and costumers. So I go at, that's why I go after silhouettes, and I let the colors be dictated by the set designer, costumer, and director. And then I'm a stickler for historical stuff if I can actually get true historical stuff. Sometimes you have to settle for something a little bit outside of a time frame. I did this last show, oh, I don't even remember the name of it now. They all blend together. I had a whole series of weapons in cases around the set.
Death trap,
thank you. One pistol that was in there was from a different time period that was not appropriate. And I got called on that by an audience member. So as a props designer, you have to be willing to hear that. And unfortunately, it does happen. Because sometimes you just can't get what you want. You have something very specific in mind, and it's not always easy to get the perfect thing.
Dan?
Well, I'm just going to take off on that in the sense that, you know, audience members seeing things, we have a unique situation here in the round because the audience crosses the stage, and that doesn't happen in most theaters. If you're in a proscenium, you're pretty removed, and so magazines don't have to be of the period of the show because they never see the date of print on there or little things like pictures on the set and so on. The audience here examines them very closely when they cross the stage to get to their seat and at intermission. So there's the practical props that the actors need that are actually a part of the show that they have to handle, and a lot of that is dictated by the script or perhaps a backstory. But then there's also set dressing, which is just things that help make the stage look a little more inhabited, make it a little more pretty, or messy in some cases, as the books in the bookcase represent. But yeah, it's without the props, I mean, it would be mine, basically.
I've got a question for you. When you're doing a period piece, and let's say, and you have a huge resource here, a lot of props, I know you do, but if you can't exactly find what you want, do you have other resources that you go to, other places that you can
for
find?
For historical guns, I normally go to Bobby.
I'm.
But, you know, I mean, I know that there's antique shops and stuff.
Well, and the Guthrie has a huge warehouse
that we
can go to and rent from, and you have to be a kind of a registered member with them. But they may not always have what you want, or what you want and have seen their previous may be out to someone else, too. And
yeah.
So,
or maybe on a Guthrie stage.
Maybe on a Guthrie stage, right?
I've worked with a company in the past couple of years called Prop It Up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they
have a variety of furniture, and they actually deliver, which
they just found out. Entire shows.
Yeah.
Like, you can just rent Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, so for a college, it's great, because we can You go there and work at these things.
That doesn't leave much for the designer to do then, though, I suppose.
Well, sometimes, though, you're maybe okay with that.
Yeah, that's it always work.
I mean, when I did come back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean here, most of that set I had boxed up with the purpose of making that available to other companies to rent the entire thing.
Where do you keep all of that stuff?
At when I first talked to Sharon about it, she kept about half of that stuff here, and it has slowly gotten pulled apart for other shows and never, so that's gone. But I have about 4 cases of the stuff in storage in my prop storage.
Many props people are also pack rats.
And
that is part of the sort of thing that attracts people to props, is we tend to like stuff. And in some ways, TRP gives us a place to sort of unload some of our stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You get to go to flea markets and find a great pot or a great vase or a great... And you know, TRP is going to use this 100 times, and because we do tons of mid-century modern-type shows. And a 1940s vase that, you know, isn't going to be a sightline issue in this space. You start to kind of know. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm not actively propping shows anymore, I love coming to shows here and seeing, oh, there's the thing that I picked up at my neighbor's garage sale 10 years ago. You know, I'm glad they're still using it.
Years ago, I did a production of Grease. And a year before, UMD did the production of Grease. And they had constructed the car.
Mm-hmm.
And they made that known that they had the car, so we could call them and go up and put it on a trailer and bring it down.
Yeah, pretty sure locally Chanhassen has the Grease car.
Yeah, so theaters will make that available.
Really well, there's a great website, Theater People, and Technical Theater.
Technical Theater on
the
budget.
You can either put a question out there, or if you have something that other people might be interested in, you can post it on that site, and then people will say, oh, good, I can go there and get that.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of that? It's a Facebook group called Twin Cities. There's like three or four Twin Cities theater groups that are on Facebook. One is called Technical Theater on a Budget.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of people in search of items.
Or
and
I'm getting rid of a bunch
items
of stuff.
Or just asking the Facebook universe, how would you handle this? How would you approach this challenge? The internet really helps a lot with helping network those kinds of questions now.
When you have to rent something from the Guthrie, do they give any sort of formal price break for a community theater, or do you pay the same thing as Park Square would?
At Guthrie, you pay a $25 fee just for your rental appointment, and then it's per item rental. So if you just rent a couch and a chair, you're going to pay just for that couch and that chair. And the couch might cost you $20 to rent, and the chair might cost you $10 to rent. If you rent a truckload of stuff, it will cost you more because you're renting a truckload of stuff.
And is the $25 membership thing, like, each time you...
The membership, it isn't exactly a formal membership so much as just knowing Sarah Gullickson's email address at the Guthrie.
And they're only open on Thursdays from 2 to 4.
Yeah.
One day a week. So you have to make an appointment ahead of time to get there. You can't go there and if you can't show up even on that day, Thursday. It's Thursdays 2 to 4. If you show up and you don't have an appointment, they won't let you walk through. So, mm-hmm. And that you have to set up an appointment also to return the stuff. Like a lot of this is from the stuff on this set is from the Guthrie. And so now this Thursday we have to return it all because the show will close.
And one thing that we frequently do is we'll piggyback appointments. Because here at TRP, we actually have so many shows just turning around that we might be returning a rental one day, and then a designer might be coming along to help maybe like tag a couch or so, or, you know, just kind of scope out what's there. That's part of the fun, is that what's there that day might be what your show looks like.
So. You just walk through and look. If you see something that's there on a day that you're just tagging, you can tag it. You can say, save this for Theater in the Round. And then they will do that. The other thing nice about that is the Guthrie space is that, yes, you pay a fee and you pay per chair, per item, but that's for however long you want to have it.
That's nice. sets.
Yeah, John Waskoff, who designed this set and has done several of my sets, likes to have as much of the real stuff up in the rehearsal room when we start as possible. Mm-hmm. So we had this whole set upstairs from day one of rehearsal.
That's nice. Okay.
So it really is. Well, I shouldn't say the whole set, most of it. Because as we go along and I walk through the prop room, I'll find something and say, you know, can we add this? Like Rick Polinek, who did my props for this show, and I were just downstairs looking and we found this little global lamp that's here on this table because we just thought it was kind of odd and different and unique, and it works, it lights up. But then the actor found a way to use it centrally yes. as she talks about
yes, she
an
does.
Event in the night, and she kind of just molests the ball of that, the globe of that lamp, so to speak. And so it works both ways that, you know, we find things. You know, I added the stand to the ashtray stand there because, you know, they talk about cigars in the show, so at some point there has to be an ashtray on the stage because obviously Roland smokes cigars if he has them on hand, and Leslie steals them. So
great. Before we move on to our next question, Mary, I want to make sure we get your, in your words, how do you define props impacting the storytelling? Because I don't think we got your answer on that question.
Well, I agree with what everybody else said. They help inform the audience about where are we and what sort of social economic strata are we looking at, and you know, they help enrich your enjoyment of the show, and especially in an arena where we don't have walls really that go all the way up. There's less information that we're able to give you sometimes in terms of a set, so the props can help bring that along. I agree with what Bobby said, that it really helps elevate a performer's experience as well. I have seen actors, just like when they get their costumes and they realize how seriously we take our technical elements in this place, that they're wearing a vintage dress in this show and that they look like $1 million in this show, that really helps elevate their performance and they take it seriously. I have to rise to this occasion. The props do the same thing. If the prop works well, it looks right, it feels good to use, and they don't have to be afraid that it's going to break. All of that helps build their confidence and all of that helps result in a better performance in the show. So even though a props person is not usually someone who's looking for glory, because a props person is somebody who helps support the show with those really thoughtfully designed elements, but you're probably never going to get noticed unless the prop fails. And that's the other thing about props, is props help move a show smoothly. When they work well, you don't notice that you're noticing the props. They are making the show move powerfully to its conclusion. But if a prop fails, or if an actor fails to use a prop, it can bring a show to a grinding halt. So props are really, really important. But don't expect to ever get applause for your props. It does happen. And in this space, you do get, sometimes you get audible response to a prop. One of the very first shows I did here was Bus Stop. So a 1950s bus stop cafe. And I remembered from my own childhood a soda pop called Lemmy. And it probably wasn't even in Kansas City at the time, which is where the show, I think, took place. But I found some old bottles of Lemmy Pop. And the first night I was watching the show and there was an audience, the guy pulled out the bottle of soda pop and popped it, and someone in the audience said, "Lemmy Pop." And then I was sold on doing props, because I had created an audible response in an audience member here. And if you're in a big proscenium house, you maybe don't ever get that kind of feedback. But here you do. And all the technical elements get that feedback here, and I think that's probably what makes actors want to work here too, is that you have such an intimate relationship with the audience, but props person can get that too here.
And case in point is when I did Five and Dime, because it takes place in a store and I had to create all this merchandise that would have been there in the 70s, as well as some stuff, because the show takes place in the 70s and then flips back to the 50s. So I had to have some stuff that had been around since the 50s, and they'd been selling for 20, 30 years, as well as newer stuff from the 70s. And I can remember opening night of Five and Dime, Steve Antonucci, the executive director here, pulled me aside after the show, and he said, I've worked here for years, and I've never had a show where an audience did not want to leave at intermission because they wanted to walk around the set. Yeah. And he said, I am literally going to have to schedule ushers to actually stand there and make sure people don't touch props now because I've got so much audience just touring the set and looking at props.
There was also a buildup of people to get in because instead of just walking to the reception, the usher went over here. Somebody would be like at the second counter over there wanting to just go as slowly as possible.
Gawker slow down. Yeah, the show.
And, you know, and then props person, some pay minute attention to little tiny detail that only maybe one audience member would notice. Five and Dime, I put mouse traps under some of the cabinetry because they would have had mouse traps in a Five and Dime to catch the rodents. I had fly strips hanging with fly speck on it.
Raisins, weren't they?
It was black pepper, ground black pepper on it. So just little tiny detail that, you know, only one or two people in this entire house would actually think, oh, that's accurate, that's cool. You know, I've gone so far as I did a show over at Walking Shadow called Gabriel. World War II, a lot of it was black market goods. The family was selling black market goods, but they had an attic bedroom they were hiding a downed air pilot in. And when the audience walked by, some of the audience actually noticed that I created dust bunnies to put under the bed and under the furniture in the attic. Because it's something that would have been there if you totally look at an attic room. So research is very important for a props designer to get an image. I'm not good at bringing images to my director, but I will go out, find images, and then talk to the director about it. So research and keeping an eye on things. Very important.
So we obviously have two directors and two props people. That's not accidental. speaking here. And you've all already kind of touched on my next question a little bit, which is kind of that relationship that you develop between the director and the props person. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of each speak to that a little bit of how that working relationship kind of works, maybe for you specifically, or how it's worked in different iterations with different designers. And Mary, I'm going to have you start first this time.
Talk about the relationship between the props person and the director?
Yep.
It depends on the director and it depends on the props person. You might have a director, we tend to have directors here who, many of them have also been designers, have worked in other technical elements, have been teachers or are teachers, so they have great empathy and they have a great respect for and understanding of the importance of technical elements, including the props. And they also need to start working with props very early in the process. Actors need to know if they're carrying a tray full of stuff, what that feels like and what the heft of that is like and how to take the stuff off the tray without the tray falling down. So we need to start working very early in the process. Really, we're at the first read-through. We're invited to all of the rehearsals. You don't have to be at every rehearsal, but you're invited to them and come to the run-throughs, come to the technical rehearsals. You're really part of the entire process as much as you want to be there. So that said, there are also directors who maybe for whatever reason don't know that much about props or period or know they want to create a certain feeling in a character or in a piece of action that happens in the show, but they really don't know how to get there, and they totally leave it up to you to figure that out. And that might be a trust factor because they've worked with you a lot, or it might be that they just haven't gotten there yet. They're really too busy dealing with blocking and high maintenance actors or something else right now. They haven't gotten that far yet. So that's part of it, is reading that relationship with your director and figuring out what do they need and when do they need it and what is my opportunity. You know, I can be doing my research. He doesn't really know if he wants it to be green or if it needs to really make a noise or how durable it needs to be. So I'm going to bring in some options. Also, asking some thoughtful questions up front in the process. Usually after I read a script, I will, and decide that I'm going to commit to the show. In the first production meeting, I will ask questions like, what are the consumables in the show? Do things get eaten or smoked or drunk or destroyed? Does the newspaper get ripped up every night? Do we need one newspaper or 12 newspapers? What things get damaged? What things are liable to be damaged? Is an actor going to be abusive of something? You know, what are my chances of having to either make a prop super durable, and you know, what are the challenges involved in that, or can I get the beautiful china teacup that we just love because it looks so pretty, but if you breathe on it, it's going to break? Is this one of those kinds of shows? You know, are we doing Arsenic and Old Lace, where you really want to have the sweet little tea sets and the sweet little, you know, wine cups and goblets, or are you doing Rhinoceros? And that also, I don't know the show Rhinoceros, but it's absurdist. I mean, there's rhinoceroses walking around. So how specific do props need to be because of the interpretation of the show? I mean, again, you can be extremely granular on this stage, where you can walk right up to a magazine, and if you know the show is supposed to be 1939, I've had to white out the date on magazines that sit on these coffee tables, because I know audience members are going to look at it and go, well, the show's 1939, but this is a 1942 magazine, because that happens.
Yep.
Just like people will tell you it's the wrong kind of gun, you know. People really get, they really care. The people who come here really care, and you're going to get nailed if you don't do it absolutely right. So the relationship changes depending on what the director needs and what resources the director brings to the show. And what type of show you're doing, whether it's realistic or absurdist. And actually, I want to hear more about the absurdist show and how that affects props. I'm not the moderator, though, so
we'll get
I'll
there.
Just
don't
wait.
Worry.
We'll get there. Yeah, yeah.
So what do you do if a prop gets added, say that it's not part of the script, but if something happens, you're just like, oh, that'd be great to have. Mm-hmm. What kind of communication goes on between you and the director to make sure that that gets communicated and
I think that happens a lot. In fact, it happened in this show, too, because in the rehearsal process, you discover you may want something that's not listed in the show or not required by the show, or as Bobby says, a character has a backstory that they want something for. But then you, stage managers are responsible for keeping a rehearsal log and sending out a rehearsal report each night, so that usually I'll just say to my stage manager, can you let Rick or whoever the prop person is know that we would like to add this and get this, or I'll talk to the prop person directly and say, Rick, we're going to need this, you know, and that glassware isn't working for me, so can we find another piece? This was just a rehearsal prop. Can we find a different style of glassware or something? That happens, I think, all the time. But I think the key word there is communication.
Yeah.
Make sure that as soon as you discover that, that gets out of there.
Right.
Yeah.
I did a show with Mary Did Props for Relatively Speaking, in which we had this bedroom, and we had decided early on that everything was pink. And Mary's one of those prop designers that you come to rehearsal and you discovered that the prop fairy has shown up during the day and just delivered stuff that you didn't know. So we would come, we'd find new pink things all over, and some of them weren't essential to the plot, but boy, it sure helped the look of things, and we just kept finding pink things and adding pink things, and so.
And it can help the actors develop bits like with your lamp, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it inspires them to add things to the performance that might help or might not help, but it gives them more options anyway.
So, but communication, I think, is the key thing. If something pops up during rehearsal, get the prop person know right away.
George or Bobby, do you have anything to add about that designer-director relationship?
Yeah, I Well, what I love about the work in the theater is it's such a collaborative art form. And so I view all of the designers as artists. And although I may come up with an idea or a concept for the play, my job then is to explain that to the designers, to the prop designers in this case, how I see it, and then let them do their thing. And their thing is to create that or to find it, which they're much better at that than I am. So they'll show you things, or this will work, or this won't, and establishing a relationship with that person so that you can talk to them and try to be as clear as possible as to what you're looking for, what I'm looking for within a certain play. And so I think that idea of their understanding what their contribution is to your play is so important.
Oh, and I have an example coming kind of from the opposite end, where Sadie and I were doing Treasure Island.
Oh yes, that great show.
And the designers got together ahead of time before we actually even talked to the director, and we were kicking around different ideas because we wanted to be very collaborative among the designers, and we hit on the concept of doing putting Treasure Island in the venue of steampunk. And steampunk is a very specific look. If you think Jules Verne on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, that type of look from the movie, or H.G. Wells, that type of Victorian, Edwardian look, everything is based on operating according to having a steam engine type thing to it. Sadie and I and Michelle Clark, the costume designer, decided we were going to push this idea or present this idea to the director. And we did, and none of us really realized right away that the director, Noah, didn't know what steampunk was. So he agreed to it without knowing exactly what the look was going to be. But once the look started to appear in stuff, he caught on.
And that was that trust element with all of us, not just with folks.
Yeah. Yeah. But all three, particularly those three design elements, mm-hmm. The set, props, and costumes really came together, and we blended our looks. It was hard to tell where set ended and props began. And some of the prop stuff ended up into costumes. So there was a nice blend among everything. And for me, it made the show very magical. And people who know, I mean, everyone knows the story of Treasure Island. They've had to read it for years. But to come and see it from a different viewpoint of steampunk just opened up everyone's eyes and made it very magical for the audience. All over again, and that was a lot of fun doing that type of experience.
Mm-hmm. Great, excellent. So my next question, we're going to come back to your curiosity about rhinoceros right away, Mary. So George, if you'd like to talk a little bit about kind of the things, like we've kind of discussed props in a very broad sense, and now kind of coming in specifically to this show, sure. What are some of the things that you really have present in your mind as you're maybe still searching for a props designer?
Yes. So. Yeah, it's really, it's always interesting, and each show is so different. Rhinoceros. I bought two scripts. One is a script you could purchase through Samuel French, and this script in the back has prop list, but that list is based on this particular production. So I may not want any or some of, or I don't know how much of this I've been going through, so you might not need any of that. Then you have a script that we're probably going to use for the actors, which they've made available here, which doesn't have that. So what I am doing is going through the script and then taking out things in the scripts that are talked about or words and that, and then thinking of other things that we might be needed. So, but first of all, I'm not doing the play in 1959. I'm doing it in a contemporary period. I'm not doing it in France. I'm doing it in America. So that adjusts some of the looks of some of the prop items that are needed. And then I have to decide how physical the play is going to be, because there are parts of it that are farce and burlesque, but so if the opening scene is in a cafe, an outdoor cafe, I'm in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, and then when these rhinoceroses run through, the furniture is going to get disrupted. The tables are going to be knocked over, the chairs are going to be thrown off stage, and that. So all of that I have to write down to know when I talk to the prop person, saying, okay, we're going to need a chair that's not going to break and throw it across the stage. Or in there's a bedroom scene, and at one point he's going to knock over the bed, and that. Okay, so those are very physical aspects to it. And then I need a dead cat. I need a
not
live,
a real dead cat.
No, I need a live cat and a dead cat. So this character comes on stage with her cat and her bag of groceries, and then the rhinoceros run through, and she drops the groceries but holds onto the cat. But then the next time the rhinoceros run through, she loses the cat, and the cat gets run over, and then she comes back on with the dead cat. So we know we're going to need a dead cat. And then, as Mary mentioned, people turn into rhinoceroses, and rhinoceroses are seen during the play. So are we talking about masks or head things? And that then becomes a discussion whether is that a prop or is that a costume? And Sharon, who does props here and is the gatekeeper, said in TRP, masks are costumes. But I've done the show before years and years ago, and the designer artist is still in town, so I called her and said, would you like to design the masks for rhinoceros? She said, yes, that'd be great. So she's going to do that and then train some people how to build them. Some are half masks, some are going to be full.
Sounds like a workshop, Sandy.
Oh, so, yeah. So, Dan, it so is. So, yeah, so,
absolutely. So that covers that part of it, which is great. And so now it's just a matter of going through and deciding how much. I mean, there's a scene where they're eating food. There's head bandages, and is that costume or is that prop? So some of the items are very specifically personal. One character turns into a rhinoceros on stage, or actually two people do on stage in front of the audience. So you have to think about how that's going to work. But I always try to approach it in this type of a play. To do as minimal props as possible. It's not like this set where you want to have, all of those things which add that texture. And in this play, which moves from scene to scene, location to location, you want to have as minimal things, in my mind, as possible. The second act scene takes place in an office. So we have to decide, okay, are we going to have tables? Are we going to have little desks? You don't want to have to move on a lot of furniture in that. So now if I moved it up contemporary from the 1950s, where they would have had typewriters, now, will we have a computer keyboard as representative of her taking notes in that? So there's some things where, as when you read the play, I have to be able to talk to the prop designer to say, okay, well, this is the time period, this is my thoughts on it, rather than what might be in the original play. So it's adjusting to that.
So after hearing that, and I know, Mary, you said you hadn't necessarily read Rhinoceros.
I have not.
And as a props person, I mean, I'm not saying that I've never done this, but every once in a while I meet with the director and maybe you haven't read the script. And then you maybe
always read the script.
But when you hear a description from a director like that, what are some of your first thoughts as a prop props person, and then Bobby, I'm going to ask you the exact same question what Mary's done.
Well, first, just a point of clarification, too, and I think we touched on it, but you mentioned, you know, chairs and props mm-hmm. kind of in the same voice. And here, we don't consider the furniture as the prop person's domain. That's really part of the sets.
Yeah.
Basically, here, if you carry it on as an actor, it is a prop. It's a hand prop. So, or if it's set dressing, it is considered a prop. So that eliminates a lot of worries right up front. But I will say at a production meeting, often there is discussion about maybe there's a lamp that there's a special, it has to be, you know, wired to actually work. Well, then that becomes an intersection of a lighting person's domain and a prop person's domain. I am the most unhandy person in the world, so you never want to ask me to have to, like, wire anything or build anything. But that's what production meetings are for, is to figure out, okay, I need a lamp, but I need it to light up. Or I need, you know, some kind of a special prop for a show, but it needs to have some kind of a... I need a dead cat, but I don't know how to build a dead cat, or I don't know how to find the, you know, whatever it is. So everybody collaborates together. It's very collaborative.
Let me give you another specific for Rhinoceros.
Yeah.
There's a scene where one of the characters, Daisy, comes to visit this character, Behringer, and he's having a pretty rough day. And she brings food. And in the script, it talks about her bringing in a basket of food and then going to the cupboards, getting plates out, setting the table, and there's another character, Duddard, there. And they're all going to have this little lunch in there. But I'm not going to have any tables, so what I want to have is a picnic for her to bring a picnic basket and spread out onto the floor, the cloth, and have a takeout meal in there, whether it's from whatever takeout we want to find, you know, that is, people go, oh, that's from, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and that. So if the designer reads the script, they'll read about this scene that takes place with a table and plates and and that, but in reality, what I like in that scene is that picnic. So that means that we have to talk about that and figure out what's going on.
And how many of those elements have to be real, and how many of them. This isn't Rhinoceros, but we did a show here, Anatomy of Grey, which was also very minimalist and just very, I mean, it had a guy falls out of the sky in a hot air balloon. Well, you know, that doesn't literally happen on our stage. You have to use your imagination. But a lot of, there were only a few select props. One of the props I needed to get in the script, it was described as a really rare hunk of steak. And nobody ever eats it. They just bring it out. And I said to Lynn, the director, what do you want? She said, how about a red plate? So I got a really blood red plate, and they brought that out, and we all knew what it was because of the way people talked about it and responded to it. So in an absurdist or in a minimalist kind of show, you don't necessarily have to be literal about everything. In fact, you probably don't want to be, because steak is expensive and it's smelly, and you don't really want that on your stage. So you also, if you're dealing with any kind of food, you know, first find out if people are actually going to be consuming it. There's a lot of gluten intolerance out there, people. There's a lot of people who can't eat or ingest certain things, and you do need to know that. I once we had a MACT festival show that we took on the road, and it involved two people eating lunch at a bistro, and we needed a breadstick. And I stopped in a grocery store on the way, and I thought to myself for a second, do I want to just get a regular breadstick or a garlic breadstick for Jenner. And I chose a regular breadstick, and I told her afterwards, I said, yeah, I just got you a regular breadstick. I hope I didn't screw up because I didn't get you garlic. And she went on to tell me a story about how she had once misread a recipe and put an entire bulb of garlic in something instead of one clove. And the very thought of garlic makes her absolutely ill, and we were going into a festival show. So it was really smart that I didn't get her the garlic breadstick. So sometimes you can just, you know, don't assume it too much. Really communicate with the people who are going to be using the props, and with your director and your stage manager and anybody else who's at all involved in it, because making what you think is a really innocent decision can, again, it can bring a show to a grinding halt, or it can be very disruptive to a show
you know, all good intentions.
Well, in that same scene, and they will be eating the food, and but one character, Dutter, who's slowly transitioning into a rhinoceros, eats flowers off of a plant.
So being able to restore that plant each night, you know, are they? If he's eating flowers, how do you create something that's an edible flower? Is it
pansies are edible?
Yeah.
There you go. That's what a production meeting is for. You brainstorm, or you go on the internet and you find out what your options are, or you go on one of those technical theater sites and say, has anybody else ever done this production? How did you deal with this particular issue?
And then I think you're talking, and what you're talking about communicating with the actor is so important with that. When we did Richard III here, there was a strawberry scene and the actor was going to eat strawberries, and he just wanted whole strawberry. He didn't want us to cut out the core or the green part. He liked to eat them just the same, so we just could put them on the plate and eat the whole thing.
Including the greens?
Including the greens, So that was talking with him about that. So it's really interesting.
But even asking people, you know, do you want, you know, because if they're drinking, because if you've been to any theater, you know there's a lot of drinking that goes on in these shows frequently, and we do have a very good selection of empty liquor bottles and decanters, et cetera, downstairs. But if somebody's going to drink something, it's very often watered down cola. But even just asking people, do you want caffeine or non-caffeine? I mean, or do you want sugar or diet? I mean, just having those kinds of sensitivities to what the actors are dealing with really helps. The actors feel like they're valued, and it all helps make it a better performance.
And that's actually one of the first questions I ask at our first production meeting. And I usually pose it to the stage manager because they're my funnel to get to the actors and to collect information from the actors. Is I'll ask, you know, we've got different types of food, what food allergies, like you said, gluten, nuts, particularly nuts, because not everyone thinks about nuts when you're getting food props. You find out from the director how much of it actually gets consumed. And a lot of times I've had directors say, oh, nothing gets eaten. Then during rehearsal, you find out that the actors are hungry and they start eating all your rehearsal food. And then you realize for the performance, you're going to have to be replenishing quite a bit of food. You know, and you haven't built that into your prop budget, which we haven't touched on prop budgets yet, and how to balance that. So again, communication through your stage manager. I know when I do liquors, I tend to stay away from all colas and sweet juices because of the sugar content, and a lot of actors, particularly if they've been singers, are very sensitive to the amount of sugar they take in during a show. Because it will affect their voices. So I tend to stay mostly with teas and diluting teas to different levels. And I actually have gone to light designers and gotten sets of gels from lighting that I match up to go to a liquor store and match up so I have the exact color of liquor, and I keep those as a separate thing to make when I make teas. Mm. And I use the gels as a base.
And actually, Rick, who, and there's drinking in this show because Roland is a drunk, uses just food coloring and water. He finds that the safest for actors. But then in this show also, there's what's called a black velvet, which is, in real life, is Guinness and champagne mixed. But I know. But it has to have a little bit of foam on it. So what we went with was root beer. But one of the root beers Rick got didn't foam very much, but a more expensive one in the bottle foamed nicely. So we had to go with that because the other one wasn't foaming.
And I had the same issue with the show I did at Park. I just closed at Park Square this summer. It had to be a beer, and the actor was okay with a soda, so I used a cream soda for the correct color of beer for the 1950s, but the director wanted more foam. So we literally took Alka-Seltzer tablets, ground them up, and put just a few granulars in the bottom of the glass. So when the actor opened the beer on stage and poured it, it created more foam. Hmm.
And that can, those can lead to more questions, because it's like, well, we can either make it look good or make it actually edible. Right. You know, does somebody actually need to eat it and then not make a horrible face?
Yeah,
afterwards.
They never drank this, so it was all about the look.
Yeah. George, was there anything else on Rhinoceros you wanted to hit on specifically props?
No, I think that's good.
Well, and what I'm hearing is we probably aren't going to break out the bone china for your show.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I do like to comment that yes, we do view chairs and that separately from props. Mm-hmm. Usually the set designer will design the chairs, but sometimes it's kind of a collaboration.
And it is a discussion point. I mean, if somebody has a watch or a purse, usually the customer wants to be the one to make that selection. Mm. Because it usually informs, it's really considered part of the costume, mm-hmm. and it's part of that character and what they would wear and how they would express themselves in their wardrobe. So those are all discussion points in the production meeting too. Is this a purse that just gets left lying on the floor and we don't know who it belongs to? Then it's probably a prop. But if it really is tied to a character, then it's probably a costume. So all of that stuff gets worked through in a production meeting.
So, Dan, I'm going to have you do a very similar thing, and we're going to do a very similar set of questions.
With Jeeves.
But with Jeeves. A very, perhaps, different play than Rhinoceros in some ways.
So this Jeeves is set outside in a garden rather than in an interior. So it's called Jeeves in Bloom, and it's set in a English garden. But a lot of the garden part of it we don't see. We don't have to see, you know, the big rose bushes that the uncle is raising. That's off stage someplace. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of patio that leads into the house and leads paths in from outside of the garden and then to other areas of the garden. But there has to be, and this is really more set than props, I guess, but there has to be something that people can hide behind. But still, you know, in a proscenium, that's easy. You build a hedge, and they hide behind it and pop up. But part of the audience can see the person behind the hedge, and some people can't, which I think is fine. The idea is that they're hidden from the other characters. There's also, in this scene, it starts kind of in the middle of the play, and then they freeze, and they go back to actually Bertie's home in London, where he gets the telegrams from his aunt saying, you need to come to the garden, you need to come out to the country, you need to come to the country. And there's like 8 telegrams that come. Because Bertie says, no, I'm not going. And each instance, the telegram gets a little more insistent until he finally decides he needs to go. So there's the tea set there in his apartment as opposed to the tea set that would be in the country. So you have 2 different tea sets. Obviously, they can't be the same one because they're in 2 different places. There's a meat cleaver that the chef comes on wielding at people. So you don't want something that's really sharp in case something happens to it. But it has to, you know, look like a real meat cleaver. And probably not one of those plastic ones that you use for Halloween either. But safety is also an issue with a lot of props. There's also a shotgun. There's a ladder that has to be brought up because they're going to plan this robbery by climbing in a second-story window to steal the aunt's own jewelry. It's called a length of rope, a lot of plants around. There's a fountain that has to probably at least simulate some kind of water in it because a manuscript gets thrown in the water and gets ruined. So that's every night. The manuscript gets thrown in the water, so you can't have, you know, you would need a different manuscript each night. You can't reuse it. Let's see, what else is it? Little things like luggage and tennis rackets. So,
what period
What year does this take place?
30s.
You're setting it in
yeah,
the
30s. Yeah, the 30s, yeah.
Okay, so things like luggage.
Right.
We have a very nice collection of luggage, by the way, in, from various periods downstairs, but
right.
that would be one of the considerations, is it's
exactly.
got to be the right
period.
The right age.
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, not only the right age, but also the right class.
Yeah.
Whether it's a poor person's suitcase or well-to-do.
And
these are
upscale
well-to-do.
Twits.
Yeah, upscale,
and
yeah.
So it's something that the script will tell you. You can ask questions of the director to make sure you're thinking along the same lines that they are, because they're the ultimate decision on what actually appears on stage.
And sometimes you might pull, it's just the challenges of being a designer, sometimes you might pull something that you think is just absolutely beautiful, and it is, but the actor just can't work with it for whatever reason. They just can't. I mean, I've watched actors that can't light matches. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, sometimes you just have to... I'm a designer. I'm not on stage trying to memorize lines and make all my cues, so I'm not here to judge. It's like you have to make it work for the persons that are using it. No judgment. So that's and it feels really good when you do succeed in doing that and you make it work for the audience and you make it work for the people that are using it.
Well, that, you know, matches brings up another thing, fire on stage for one thing, candles and whatever, but also just the idea that if you have a lighter, you have to make sure that if they use it,
it works.
It works. So that during the course of the run, does the flint wear out? Does it dry up from fluid? The stage manager is probably responsible for checking that in the run to make sure that it's... But then the fluid has to be available to them from the prop person to be able to refill that lighter or replace the flint if it needs
fountain,
to be.
And that brings to mind fountain pens. Again,
yeah.
We do so many shows that take place in a period where fountain pens would have been used, and fountain pens... There's a reason why people don't use them that much anymore, because they malfunction, they dry up, they don't work that well. But here, again, on this stage, if you leave a fountain pen sitting on a desk, if you leave a ballpoint pen sitting on a desk that in a show that takes place in the 40s, your audience is going to call you out on that. And to get a working fountain pen, I mean, I've invested in working fountain pens that I just keep at home, or that we keep locked up because they tend to walk away. It's just easy for that stuff to just walk away. So, yeah.
So it's my stuff is a little more practical in terms of realistic kinds of things, you know, some dishware, but things that would be around, mm-hmm. but yes, they need to fit the time period. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's, and there's not a lot of props mm-hmm. in this show. Couple of odd things, like, you know, a meat cleaver being wielded at people. And
is the talk about the fountain a little more? Is the fountain a garden?
It's a garden
amenity?
Fountain, yeah. And it is actually. It also has a stat. This is a set thing to me too.
Yeah.
A statue of a girl. So whether it's a small thing set up on top, it obviously in this arena can't be a tall, full length, high statue.
Yeah.
It probably be something on top of the fountain, perhaps even.
But it might be actually spouting water.
It could be,
yeah. So that probably will be mostly a set piece,
yeah,
and not a prop.
Not a prop, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the manuscript being thrown in the water each night would be certainly a prop.
Excellent. So we've obviously described two very different styles of shows, an absurdist and a very kind of realistic replication. So I'm wondering if you can kind of eat... So a props person kind of needs... to either know how to meet the needs of both those shows or kind of identify, like, maybe I'm not going to jive with an absurdist style show because that's just not my jam. So from each of you, what do you think are some of the most important skill sets that a props person needs to have so that they can kind of go from show to show?
Well, Mary talked about the fact that she says she's not very practical in terms of making things.
I'm not handy.
Right.
Yeah.
So props that you have to build would probably not be so much your... But you're a great scavenger.
Yeah.
You can find things and you...
Yeah.
You know, garage sales you talked about, you know,
yeah.
going to used stores, you
yeah.
know.
I grew up in a house full of antiques, so I've always enjoyed and kind of been knowledgeable, for a kid anyway, knowledgeable about Victorian and Edwardian and early American stuff because I just was surrounded by it. So I always had an affinity for that kind of stuff.
And I've also, you know, through the years, I've leveraged a lot of that, my family's stuff, on this stage. I mean, my great-grandmother's bloomers have been on this stage, hanging on a line in that Anatomy of Grace show. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know how to build things. TRP is great. I mean, people like Tony can put you in touch with people who can build stuff. We created a crate for 84 Charing Cross Road, where it was a care package. I needed a wooden crate that would be opened, filled with Excelsior and tin cans of vegetables and fruits and soup and a smoked ham. And, okay, some of that stuff I could do, and some of it I had no way that I was going to be able to do it. But we know people here. So we farmed out the project of building a crate of a certain size and shape to one of our builders, and she did a beautiful job with it. I mean, she worked with me to communicate how big it needed to be, how sturdy it needed to be, the surface it was going to get set on, you know, how it needed to be built, and then I put stickers on it that made it look like it had been shipped. I was able to source vintage labels from the internet and print them out and wrap them around soup cans and vegetable cans to make them look like the right period. We found somebody else who built an absolutely beautiful smoked ham, somebody who can build, and again, I don't have that skill, but we know people here. So it was really a collaborative effort just making that one prop. And that is one of my favorite props, I think, that we've ever done here, because it was such a meaningful part of the show. It was Christmas time, and these people in London post-war didn't have anything. Somebody sent them this care package, and they open it up, and they take out, I think there was a rubber ducky in there.
Yeah.
It was just really sweet, and it was all the right period. It all had the right look. It was meaningful. And I could tell as the actors were working with it that it was meaningful to them, too. It made a really beautiful scene. So I don't remember the question anymore.
Well, the idea was pairing up with the quality of what is needed in the show. And you said that you were not someone to build, but you
I'm not a builder,
resources.
But we can still make it happen. Right, yeah. I mean, you coordinate the effort working with the staff here and with other volunteers here, and you network.
I can't remember what show it was for now, but I think it's still downstairs. That pig head that needed to be roasted.
Yeah.
And that was built, you know.
Yeah.
How do you put the eyes in it? Were marbles or something? And did you build that?
Greg Johnson, the assistant executive director here, built that. And he did quite a bit of research on how to do it. Mm-hmm. And if I remember right, they originally cast a real pig's head to get the underform of it.
Yeah.
I don't remember all the details he went into on creating that.
So really, having any particular technical skill is not as important as being well organized, knowing as soon as possible in the process what your limitations are going to be in terms of what you yourself can deliver, and then reaching out to coordinate that effort with others who can help you deliver it. So if you know you need a smoked ham, a fake smoked ham built, or a pig's head built, you need to raise your hand early in the process and say, okay, that's beyond me, I can't do that. How can we pull people together to make this happen? Does somebody have one? Does somebody already know somebody who used one in another show?
Well, and that brings up, Prime Minister Gene Brody, there's the artist who has all these paintings that we see, and we actually got that prop person because when she saw the list that, she's a painter, so when she saw the list of that needed all those paintings, she was interested right there. And so she actually painted the nude of the girl, and then, you know, it's in process, so it was, so we had that, but she was interested in doing that because she's an artist painting.
At another show, Panache, it took place in the apartment of an artist, and we needed a bunch of his work, and it all needed to look like it came from the hand of the same artist, so I went out and I networked until I found an impressionist style artist here in town who was willing to loan us his work. So, you know, you don't always have to build it or make it either. You can find it.
Yeah.
Another favorite prop story here about serendipity is, you know, don't assume that anybody can't help you, because the whole universe potentially can help you. I needed a silver toast caddy, which is just like a little rack that you put toast in if you're in a British play. And we didn't have one.
And I was looking in antique stores, and I didn't have much money, and I just couldn't afford the ones that I was seeing, and I was just racking my brains trying to figure out how I was going to get a silver toast caddy. And one day I was telling my friend Gail that I needed a silver toast caddy, and I was just at the end of my rope. And Gail was literally living out of a suitcase at this point, house-sitting for a series of friends. She had no home. And she said, oh, I think I have one. She used it to keep mail in. It was something, it was some heirloom of her family's, and it was one of the few possessions that she had, and she loaned it to us for the show, and it was the perfect thing. So don't assume that anybody, the world is filled with helpful people, and people like to be asked. They really do. Another thing I take away from years ago doing props here, I asked a guy that I didn't know. You become fearless about just asking random people for things. I needed, I think it was for bus stop, I needed like a cake display or something that would be in a bakery. And I called this guy who had such things in his store, and I asked him if he could possibly lend it to us. And he said, sure. And I was kind of just stunned that he was willing to do this. And I started rambling about how grateful I was, and I can give you tickets. I don't have any money. I can give you tickets. And he said, Mary, you got to understand, most people are bored. And when somebody calls them out of the blue and asks them just kind of an out of the blue question and asks them for their help,
they're willing.
It's interesting. It's something different from their usual daily grind. And so he was happy to help. He felt like he had done a good deed that day. And the tickets were nice. But, I mean, people like to help if they can. So I've learned a lot doing props here.
And I'm more of a builder than Mary, by far. I take pride in being able to build as much odd stuff as I can. That's why I'm kind of interested in rhinoceros.
Get cats, for
so
example.
Having things like that thrown at me intrigues me enough to actually turn down paying gigs just to be able to build something unique, because I can have that in my prop resume. I got approached by Linda here to do Fahrenheit 451, which is futuristic, scientific, or sci-fi type show, and I had to build flamethrowers for several of the characters. But they had to be futuristic. And when she first called me and asked me if I'd come sit and talk to her about the show, she said, I just got the show 2 weeks ago. We don't start production meetings for 6 months, but I want to approach you to do props, and you are the first designer I'm approaching, and I cannot think of a different designer that would be capable of building this wide assortment of odd things. And would you take this on? I'm giving you as much time as I can to let you build ahead of time. And it stroked my ego, so of course I had to say yes to it. Just the idea of having to build a flamethrower with the idea of having something that looks like it would really function on stage intrigued me. But I got to build, 8 or 10 different props that were built from scratch for that show. And when we got done with the show, and TRP doesn't have a lot of storage room, or as much as I think they should, actually. Let me rephrase that. They should be saving more props than what they do. But Sharon's like, we're going to have to throw away or take these apart for their parts. But there were a few select pieces. She's like, this is unique enough. I want to keep this. And one of those was a EMT's suitcase that was plexiglass on one side, with mechanical moving parts inside of it. So when they're doing EMT stuff, there was actually things that lit up and moved in there that the audience could see. Even in the half light that was going on during that scene. So being able to build can be a good thing, but also, like Mary said, having connections and knowing what your limitations are and being able to reach out to people for stuff is a very good thing, or knowing where to search for something. Two of my favorite internet prop sites, one is called Prop Agenda, and the other is PropPeople.com. And usually there's a lot of, or at least some, Broadway prop designers that are connected with those two sites that do stuff. And you can always reach out and post on those sites and ask for suggestions on how to do stuff. Right now, YouTube is a great place for me. I've been researching how to make fake food. I had potentially had a show to do over at Mixed Blood where I was going to have, it takes place in a restaurant kitchen, and I was going to have to do a lot of fake food. And they ended up giving the design to a different prop designer, but I've still been researching. Even after I found out I wasn't getting the design, I still wanted to learn that technique on how to make the fake food. So I spent a lot of time looking at how-to videos. And we'll go down to my... I've got a couple of workshops in my basement where I'm able to actually go down and recreate what I was just watching a video of and making stuff that I have absolutely no show to make it for. I'm just making it because I want that technique, being able to do that.
Does a 3D printer, do you think that will be something that will come in handy in the future?
Yes.
Eric wants us to get a
3D printer. Someday, Theater in the Round will have to get a 3D printer. Yeah. The two things, as a props designer, I think TRP should have. One is a 3D printer, and the other is a plot printer, so we could print our own newspapers.
Yeah.
If anybody in this country created a business of just making and being able to make and design newspapers and magazines for theater companies and movies, you'd make a killing. Because right now, the few companies that you can order this stuff through, a newspaper costs minimum $7 per newspaper. And if you have a newspaper that's destroyed every single performance, that'll eat your entire budget.
And if you need a New York Times newspaper, good luck, because you're not going to get it. Yeah. I mean, sometimes New York Times will have old reprints, but it's usually like, you know, Pearl Harbor or something that you famous, don't want screaming headlines on your newspaper. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if you have money and can afford a plot printer, there's a business for you out there. If you're good at doing graphics,
Bobby, is you get yourself a plotter printer and just make newspapers
and,
for
and
theater companies.
Yeah, you can make a killing at it.
Yeah.
George, did you have anything that you wanted to speak to about the skill sets of a props person?
Yeah, sure. Last season I directed Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and had some very specific props, and one was a brain. They were in the operating room, and it was the doctor lecturing to surgical students, and he picks up out of the bowl a brain, the brain, he says. And so, well, it had to look like a brain. And Maureen was doing my props for that, and she went and she did some research and found how to make this brain that looked like a realistic brain. And it had to have some weight to it, so you couldn't just have a paper thing. It had, because the actor has to pick it up and has to have some weight and that. And he handles it, so it had to be substantial enough so it wasn't going to fall apart when he was handling it, because it wasn't just sitting there. And she found out how to do this and made this thing, and made several, went through different, you know, she was very, you know, caring about what it wanted to look like. She talked to the actor, what he was going to do with it. It was just a really wonderful process that she went through and came up with this great prop. And when he pulled it out of the bowl, there it was in the audience, and he was right there. So, you know, they're very close, and people were looking and going, ooh, that looks like a brain. And that, and play, of course, a prop table backstage with the brain. So, and it lasted pretty much the entire run, if I remember correctly. So, which was nice.
Great.
Yeah.
But consumables, food-wise, is one thing, but when I did Tis Pity She's a Whore here, there's a heart that needs to be brought up at the end, a bloody heart, you know. And so we had a butcher who, and of course, you keep that around, it's, you know, a real one's going to smell after a while.
Yeah.
But we had a butcher who was willing to give us one each week, so that they only had to last the weekend.
Yeah.
But then we had to add, you know, the stage blood to it to make it redder, but then we still had to keep it from a Friday night to a Saturday night to a Sunday matinee in the container in the refrigerator in the kitchen. And then, you know, take it out early enough so that it wasn't cold, you know, for the actor to handle, you know, the time that they had to bring it on stage, blood running down the arm at the same time.
Well, and occasionally you'll get to do props where you can blend it with other design elements. I did Rebecca here, and one of the things I talked with David Corll, the director, about is every time the presence of the wife that had passed away, every time her presence was supposed to be on stage, I had a vase of roses coming on stage, carried on by the butler or one of the other characters. So every time her presence was there, roses were appearing. And one of the elements we played with was pumping rose fragrance through the house during that time when those roses came on stage. So the audience actually got a feeling of presence coming in and dissipating. And it was just, it was an element that was fun to play with. We did the same type of thing with Treasure Island, having the sea salt smell being pumped in. So I remember that. That was a joy.
So I'm a little conscious of time because I think we said maybe an hour and a half for this. And I know we could go on talking about props forever because they're amazing. But I think I'll give each of you just kind of one last thing to say about props because maybe we haven't covered in some of our questions or our conversations already. Just any kind of topic or statement about props that you'd like to kind of wrap up the presentation with.
So. Read your script, create your prop list, have that prop list available to talk over with the director, the stage manager, your actors, sooner rather than later. I've tried different times over the years having the prop list at the very first meeting, and then you're having to rewrite a lot of it and or re-find a lot of it. Other times I've let it become very organic and only built it as it was called for from the stage manager's notes, and sometimes that made it very hard to find stuff at the last minute. So be aware of what's needed and what might be needed, and just have that in the back of your head. And check out your time periods. Being able to, I mean, if you were to go downstairs to the last row in the prop room downstairs and look at all the glassware, being able to identify time periods just by looking at the glassware and knowing what decade those glasses would have come from. That type of knowledge will really help because you'll get people that will call you on it.
Or know the difference between a brandy snifter and a champagne tulip glass or something. As a director, I think this is kind of what I said to you, Louise, earlier, was that the communication is really what's important right from the beginning. Have that prop list and compare your, as a director, your prop list with what the designer's prop list is. And one of the tough things is sometimes you'll say, you know, we decided to cut that. Or, you know, that isn't working. Can you redo that or find something different? And sometimes with glassware, that might be a little easier than, sorry, that pig head just looks terrible. Can you redo it? Something that's built. Just that communication factor with your designer right from the beginning, I think, is really
And also, for me as a director, I try to be as specific as possible as to what I'm thinking about for the particular prop. But then designers can surprise you. You might be thinking about one thing, you say, okay, I want this, and they'll say, well, would this work? And you go, ooh, yeah, there it is. Yeah, that's the thing I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
It just pops into your head. And then during the rehearsal process, the props that come up, actors will come to you and say, you know, I'd really like to have this here. I really need a pen here. I need to do this. And you go, okay. And then you think about it for a while, and you mention it to the stage manager so they can make it aware to the prop designer. And then a week later, the actor comes by and goes, nah, you know, I don't really think I'm going to be using that at all. And you go, okay. And then you make sure they tell the prop designer, oh, cut that. They're not going to be using it now. They don't want it. And then, but of course, there comes a point where you go to the actor and go, no, you can't do that. You're not doing that every week. But that like Dan said, the communication is really, really the key. And having a visual, an idea of what you're looking for. Or at least be able to describe
and the style.
Something in the style. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also asking the question early, you know, what does the actor need to work with in terms of actual props early on?
Well, and that brings up the idea of rehearsal props as opposed to actual props. I mean, if you're doing fine china, you don't want that at the rehearsal space where they've got a book in their hand. Yeah. You don't want that fine teacup there at that moment. You just want even a mug or something at that point, just so they get used to handling it, because that teacup is going to be delicate and special. And what you said earlier, too, that when they get that in the rehearsal process, then that just ups them a little
real
bit.
Mm-hmm. For them,
yeah.
But then there's also some practical props that, you know, they really do need to work with the actual thing. Maybe it doesn't have to be finished or painted, but they need to know, you know, if it's a special secret compartment in a something or other that they have to manipulate and use, and it's going to be difficult for them to do it immediately. They need to have time to work with it too. So knowing what those props are, and show up and watch a run through. That's really informative,
really cool.
And it gives
really
cool, you information that you would not get any other way.
It's great for a director when the prop designer comes to your rehearsal, because you know they're really thinking about what it is.
The light comes on all of a sudden. It's like, oh, that's what they're going to do with it.
Yeah. How are you going to be using it? Yeah. We did Jekyll and Hyde. One of the key props was a cane. That was a sword cane. And, you know, we just had a cane for rehearsals until we could get the actual sword cane. We were trying to get it as soon as we possibly could, because it weighs different and how they move with it. And the cane was passed around all the different hides. So that was very important when we got it. Of course, when we got it, the first thing that happened is the actor broke it. So we had to get another one. And it was a faulty sword cane. So the company, we were able to get a new one. But then we had the way we decided, well, we better have two.
In case it breaks.
So we had two, just in case.
You know, even glassware, you sometimes backstage in the prop table have an extra one that matches in case something happens during the run or backs it up.
Yeah, I would underline that two or three times.
Yes.
I'm out of all the prop designers I know, I'm probably the most superstitious one. I will only see a show that I've propped once. Any other time I've seen a show more than once, I've watched props break on stage.
And it's your fault.
When I'm in the house, and my first instinct is to get up and run down there and fix it. And I have literally started to move out of my seat, and my partner has pulled me back. Because
you can't do it.
I don't do that.
And so I literally will not see a show a second time once I've seen it the first time. Once it's open.
Can I just... Something interesting about props on this stage, too. We were doing arsenical lace. We had a candy dish. People would cross the stage during intermission or before the show and help themselves to the candy out of the candy dish. They would just, oh, good. And one time, and it was a show that Janice Stone directed, there was a table over there that had a Kleenex on it, and there was like... Two Kleenexes had to be in the box because they were used. I was sitting up there with Janice, and a client, audience member, came in kind of late, came by, saw that there, she was going up into section E, she grabbed the Kleenex because she grabbed it out of there, and I said, Janice, she just took one of the Kleenexes. Janice had to quickly get out of her seat, goes tell, because we had the house hadn't really, I mean, the house was open, but the show hadn't started yet, but it was almost time. She went to the stage manager and said, we've got to replace that because it was used. Two Kleenexes were important in that box. And the audience member had taken one out and used it as she passed by to go up to her seat. I mean, it's little, that's what happens when you have the audience cross your stage. It's different than a proscenium, for example.
Yeah. I did a show called Loot, and we had a funeral buffet set up right there in front of F, with food on the table, and on two different occasions, we had audience members reach over the
modesty panels,
thank you, and grab food candy out of the dish to go to eat it. And of course, there was some real food on there, but most of it was fake food. And they just happened to grab the fake food and couldn't eat it. But the fact that, you know, the lights going down right after intermission, the table's set up, all of a sudden a hand comes out of the dark, grabs a piece of candy, and you hear it rattling in the dark, and then it stops when they realize it's fake food.
They put it back? Then?
And then it appeared under their seat after the show was over. So, I mean, that maybe that fake food shouldn't have been quite so exact, but...
Well, that brings up the whole idea of modesty panel and things on the modesty panels and that too. That's a different story.
That's a whole topic.
Well, I'm going just to food on stage. I remember when they did Saturday, Sunday, Monday. We had a stove that was actually hooked up. And pre-show, the actress was on stage actually cooking the spaghetti sauce and the spaghetti during the show, because the whole first scene is them sitting down and having their spaghetti dinner. So she was on the stage, the stove was actually wired up, she was there cooking the tomato sauce and the spaghetti and then serving it up. So you walked in and you could smell, of course, the spaghetti sauce cookie.
That's why people eat the food.
That's why.
Mary, did you have any last thoughts?
My husband acts here also. This is a prop story. He played a Nazi in Bent, and there's a very dramatic scene in which he comes out as a stormtrooper, and he grabs this poor man, and he slits his throat. And then the lights go down, and it's the end of the scene. And one night, he came in through the AVOM, and right before he came in, he had dropped his knife. And did not realize until he was on stage that his knife was still backstage. This is an example of how props can bring a show to a grinding halt. Fortunately, he had a machine gun. I was his props person, so he had another weapon. That night, he just shot the guy, and the lights came down. So, be prepared.
Yeah.
They don't know your husband. He has a history of things going on.
Yeah, that's another whole podcast.
There was something else one time, a knife and something, and it wasn't on the set or something, and and I don't know where this story came from or who it's about, but I'm going to kill you with this poison jelly, and they threw the food product at the person. Said, this is poison jelly. And the sword cane thing, when I was doing my master's work at Northwestern, we did the Rivals, and they used a sword cane. One guy pulled it out one night, went like this, and the blade flew out into the audience and landed right between two people.
Wow.
Now, the odd thing about that is that we're in rep with the misanthrope, and a modern version of it, and they popped the cork in a champagne, and it also flew out into the audience. It landed between the same couple.
Oh, no.
The blade in between.
They're thinking.
So, yeah. I hope they ever came back to any of the shows, but that's just a great story. Too many stories, too much history.
Our panelists will hang around if you want to ask them more stories. Otherwise, thanks for coming and listening. We really appreciate it. Obviously, we've mentioned throughout this conversation the volunteer aspect of Theater in the Room. So if you're interested in volunteering, talk to Tony in the back. If you're listening on the podcast, you can email Tony, too, if you're interested in volunteering. So thanks for showing up this morning, everyone. Thank you.
We always look for prop volunteers.